You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM.
Cuba, 1961. A quarter of a million volunteers taught 700,000 people to read and write in 1 year. The World Community Film Festival begins next Friday at Langara, and a film about this remarkable project will open the festival. Maestra explores this story of the Cuban Literacy Project through the personal testimonies of the young women who went out to teach literacy in rural communities across the island and found themselves deeply transformed in the process. Catherine Murphy is the director of Maestra. In our conversation, I began by asking her about the campaign.
Cuba in 1959 and 1960 had 6 million people. And 1 million of those people were illiterate, you know, and functionally illiterate, and some completely illiterate men and women, many of whom had never had the opportunity to go to school at all. So there was a census in the 50s measured 1 million of the 6 million, you know, men and women on the island to be illiterate. And one of the first things that the new government set out to do was to build a national education system, and they saw the first huge leap toward that to be carrying out a massive national campaign for literacy and to give everyone the opportunity to come up to a first grade reading level, which was their goal in that first year. So Cuba actually announced at the General Assembly of the United Nations in 1960 that they would become free of illiteracy in 1 year. And it just was a seemingly impossible thing to do. And they made an open call for volunteer teachers. A quarter million people volunteered. Half of those, over half of those were women volunteer teachers, and about 100,000 of them were under 18, mostly young people between 14 and 17 years old who went en masse to the mountains and valleys of the country and lived with the students. They would teach rural families mostly, although there was a lot of literacy teaching going on in the cities and urban shanty towns. The rural students or the young people who went to rural areas are in some ways more the focus of the Maestra film. And they lived with the students they would teach. They worked alongside them in the daytime and taught classes on nights and weekends.
One of the remarkable things about the film is that it does tell the story through the voices of the young women who taught. How did you connect with these women who are now in their 60s?
Well, I grew up very close to my grandmother, who grew up in Cuba in the early years of the last century, and so I was sort of raised, my sister and I were largely raised on their stories of their own childhoods from Cuba. You know, all those stories happened in Cuba. Cuba was sort of a magical, mythical place to me, but of course the U.S. Doesn't have diplomatic relations. It's not with Cuba, and it's been very difficult to travel to Cuba for many decades. So I didn't actually know anyone who had ever been to Cuba, just these stories from my grandma. So I set out to go to Cuba in the early 90s to sort of explore this part of my family history and to learn about Cuba now. And I was so, you know, from the moment I set foot on the island, I was so just amazed by, you know, A, this sort of the other side of the story as opposed to what we hear in the U.S., but also the incredible lessons that the Cubans who stayed on the island after 59, you know, what they envisioned for a country for themselves and what they tried to build. And I got sort of fascinated with that, and also what their lessons are for the rest of us.
So when you decided to make the film, how did you then connect with some of the people who were principals in the story?
Yeah, I stayed in Cuba for much of the 90s studying, and I had the really incredible fortune to meet a number of the women, Daisy Vetia, who was a leading hospital architect, Norma Guillard, who's a leading social scientist, Hino Ray, who was a urban planner and the founder of one of the first non-governmental organizations that was created in the 90s. And because I was studying in Cuba, I was studying social sciences at the University of Havana, I just had the fortune, I'd say, and, you know, just being in Cuba and exploring Cuba. And I was also working with a number of community organizations and NGOs in the U.S., nonprofits that were starting to do work in Cuba and starting to explore, like, cultural and academic exchanges with Cuba. So I just had the opportunity to meet some of these incredible women because of the work they're doing now. But several of them said that they felt like the most meaningful thing they'd ever done was when they taught someone how to read and write as young adults. And that, you know, by the time the third or fourth woman said that to me, it kind of grabbed me. I thought, there's a larger story here, you know, what is that? So, you know, I initially really set out just to do a very small film about this small group of really amazing, inspiring women that I knew. But it just grew and grew, I think, when I realized the magnitude of the campaign and what it meant, you know, its relevance, its importance for the social history of the Americas. I just got kind of pulled in more and more and fell more in love with the story, and also, I guess, started to feel some kind of responsibility to share it with the U.S. in particular, where people have so little opportunity, so few opportunities to go to Cuba, and, you know, so much of what we hear about Cuba is negative. And so I wanted to help share these more sort of human stories from Cuba, but also to help folks think here in the U.S. about, you know, literacy itself, which is something we're really still struggling with.
I think it's a very the film's very moving, and it's a beautiful film. And one of the most compelling things really is the stories of these young women, you know, 12 years old, 13 years old, 17 years old, and they were living in the city and face, you know, obvious reactions from their parents when they said, I'm going to the country to teach literacy to campesinos or farmers. What was the reaction that overall from the women and from their parents?
Well, you know, when the campaign started, and part of why I focused on the women, was because really it was a massive turning point for them in their own lives, because there had been so few opportunities or such limited opportunities for Cuban women in the 50s, like much of the world. So, you know, when the young men ran home to tell their parents that they wanted to go to the mountains during the literacy brigade, the parents generally, you know, not always, but generally agreed and supported the idea and thought, you know, yes, my son is going to go do something great, you know, and he's going to become a man. Whereas when the young women went to tell their parents, the parents, even if they very much supported the revolution and supported the literacy campaign, were very fearful and very reticent, and many of them forbade their daughters to go. So these young women started to enter into a process of negotiation with their parents, and one, because you had to have both parents' signatures in order to join the campaign. The parents had to agree and sign these, their application forms. And for the young women to convince their parents, and their fathers in particular, to let them go, was really this negotiation of the largest degree of autonomy that women had ever known in Cuba up until that point. And it really was a before and after moment for all of the women that I spoke to. And I came to see it as a before and after moment for Cuban women in general, because there were 50,000 You know, it was like a teenage girl uprising of sorts. And when those young women came back down from the mountains, they never thought about life in the same way. And they didn't think about themselves in the same way either. So they were so profoundly transformed, both by the beautiful, liberatory endeavor of teaching others how to read and write, but also because of learning what they were capable of doing as women.
You had some absolutely fabulous archival footage, both what appeared to be photographs, that, you know, family photographs, but also all kinds of archival footage of it. Where were you able to source all of that?
Yes, that was the result of about 5 years of archival research. It was sort of like archaeology. The archives are incredibly beautiful in Cuba, and you know, archives all over the world, especially the Cuban archives, are spectacular. We got the moving images mostly from the National Film Archive, which is coordinated by ECAIC, the National Film Institute in Cuba. We also got a little clips from the television, from Cuban TV, and a few clips from a couple independent documentary makers in the United States. One is a wonderful documentarian named Sonia DeFries, who lives in Louisville, Kentucky, and she had made a wonderful documentary called Gay Cuba in the early 90s and had some footage that she donated to this film, and then we got the permission from ECAIC to use it. But also a lot in the photographic archives, like Bohemia Magazine, the National Library of Cuba, the Literacy Museum, and anyone who, you know, is planning, listening, that might be planning a trip to Cuba or has been there and going back, the beautiful museum that was opened to honor this campaign is on the outskirts of Havana in the Ciudad Libertad sort of educational complex. It's a very moving museum there to the literacy campaign, and we were able to access the archives there as well and got a lot of the images from them, and also the personal archives of the women that we interviewed, and others who were there. Some of the photographers from the time donated images as well.
On a final note, I wanted to say that the music was quite compelling. Anybody who's been to Cuba knows that it's a land of music. There's so much spirited, beautiful music there, and so the music for the film was also wonderful. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, most of the music, or much of the music, are original songs made for this film, mostly by Cuban composers. Although there's a wonderful young woman, Venezuelan composer named Haleen Williams, who did some of the more contemporary sounding tracks. And at the end, there's a beautiful voice singing over the credits. That's Haleen Williams, a 23-year-old young woman composer from Venezuela. She made a song out of a poem that was written by Eduardo Saborit, a Cuban poet and songwriter. He wrote a beautiful tribute to the literacy campaign called Despertar, and Haleen Williams did a sort of a contemporary musical interpretation of that. And the lyrics say, you know, like it's Despertar means awakening or waking up, you know, that through learning how to read and write. Other composers include Aldo Lopez Gavilan, wonderful young pianist. He does jazz and classical music, and much of the piano music is by him. Also a young tres player from Cuba named Lino Lores, and Michael Elizarde. The tres is a traditional instrument, so we're looking at getting some original compositions with tres that maybe had a little more contemporary feeling. I'm really delighted that you like the music. It's quite eclectic. It's sort of multi-genre music, but very much rooted in Cuban musical tradition. But I sort of felt, you know, one of the things that we thought about a lot was how to try to make sure the story from Cuba 50 years ago will feel relevant to young people, you know, in the U.S. and Canada and maybe Northern Hemisphere countries. Definitely for me it was important in the U.S., where there are so many young people that struggle with reading and writing and that struggle with graduating from high school and that maybe have never heard of Cuba. So the music was really that bridge, I think, to sort of bring it into the present, to help bring it into the present in some immediate way, and a big piece of the film, a big piece of the story.
Well, it's been absolutely wonderful talking to you this morning.
Likewise, thank you so much for having us, and enjoy the festival.
I spoke with Catherine Murphy, the director of Maestra from New York City, and you can find out more about the film at maestrathefilm.org and at facebook.com/maestrathefilm. They're building an oral history archive around literacy in general and Cuba in particular, and Maestra is spelt M-A-E-S-T-R-A.
This podcast was produced by the Red Eye Collective in Vancouver, B.C., If you live in the Vancouver area and are interested in creating alternative radio with us, we'd love to hear from you. Contact us at redeye@cooperadio.org.